Welcome to Conductor's Brew. I am Larry Spell, and joined always by my co-host and friend, Matt Minella. And Matt, good to see you again back here in the front yard. This is two for two outside, so we are doing well with the weather.
Is this the second week in a row we've been outside?
This is the second week in a row we have been outside.
And I have to say, it is a gorgeous day. Not as warm as it's been.
No, it's
still
cool
palatable.
Spell.
Yeah, and Brendan is here with us as well today. So we've got a trio in the front yard today.
Yeah, yeah, a smaller crew, but a crew nonetheless.
Oh,
yes,
man.
Thank you
still
for being back.
No,
I just got a really good whiff of like garlic cooking and olive oil.
Or
did you get that too?
Yeah,
oh, it's making me crazy hungry.
Somebody getting early start on dinner. Okay, so we're here, and we're here in the afternoon today, so
yeah.
We're not drinking coffee. We're drinking tea, Matt, which
yes.
is also, if anybody follows your feed, you are a tea fan.
I'm a teaholic.
A teaholic.
Yeah.
The brew of the day was originally tea.
It was.
Yeah.
The brew of the afternoon, technically. It was
and
always the brew of the afternoon.
And we're in the afternoon,
in the afternoon.
What is our brew?
Our brew today is a wonderfully light, delicious, fragrant jasmine green tea.
And this I smell is, a lot of that jasmine.
Oh, it's so good. And it's a nice light kind of light on the palate, that is. Oftentimes, if I order green tea in a restaurant, people don't know how to make tea. They'll just pour hot boiling water over a tea bag, and it comes out ridiculously bitter, and it's disgusting. Does this taste like that to you, Larry? Or is
it does not taste disgusting.
It's very delicate,
right? No, it tastes very delicate, and I get a lot of the jasmine.
Good.
Let me take another
That's
sip
the
here
whole
and
point.
Think about this.
Yeah. Me too, here.
I taste the jasmine, but I also feel like it's a little bit of an orange blossom smell to it. I could just be my imagination.
No, that's good. No, you're absolutely right. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But jasmine has sort of that almost a sickly sweetness to it. If you've ever been to the South, you've smelled the Confederate jasmine.
Yeah.
And this is what that reminds me of.
I was about to say, this is like drinking a warm summer evening.
Mm.
This is like sitting on the porch. Smelling that jasmine on the breeze.
Oh, it's so good.
The humidity.
It's golden, pale
thick
golden
in the air.
Green liqueur.
Yeah.
And it's a little silky on the tongue. It's got kind of like a fullness to it.
That's that humidity. It gives you the essence of the thick, humid air of the South.
Anyway, this is a local buy. This is from, I'm going to plug an apothecary just up the road here in Salt Lake City in the Avenues neighborhood. There is an apothecary called Green Thread Herbs. And I think I've talked about them before on the show because they have my favorite Earl Grey ever. They import it from Italy. It's specially made for them. And this Earl Grey is just divine. I mean, it smells just like bergamot oranges. Yeah, way better than the teabag stuff, which is kind of stale, I think.
I knew bergamot was a fruit. Is it a citrusy?
It's a type of orange.
Oh,
I think,
my goodness.
I think it's native to Italy.
I'm pretty sure
the name is not Italian. Bergamot. I don't know.
I couldn't tell you.
I looked this up once. It's not Bergamo. It was not French.
No.
The T is pronounced, in case you were wondering. But yeah, shout out to Green Thread Herbs, where they can take care of all of your herbal needs. And I highly recommend them for some of their teas as well, especially the Earl Grey and the jasmine.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, this is delicious stuff. It's a great afternoon tea.
Yeah, it's a nice little pick-me-up, too. Just a little bit of caffeine
and
green tea.
I've got a rehearsal later this evening, and so it's good to have a little bit of a tea jolt. By the way, I meant to say last week, I'm excited that I'm back with the Wasatch Symphony. We took some time off as things were spiking, and now things have gone down. I mean, we're still following all the pandemic protocols. Everybody's wearing masks, and we're meeting in a large gym with just the strings and spread out. So we're still being as careful as we were before, but it's nice that to get back and get in front of that group again. And hopefully we'll have a recording that I can plug soon. I did make a recording with my Taylorsville and College Symphonies.
Last week.
And I will have those up, and I will be shamelessly plugging those soon. And speaking of shameless plugs, we need to plug an appearance that you and I made on Coffee with the Maestro, Silas Huff's show.
Silas Huff.
It just went up today, so it's on Facebook. So you could I think you just go to Coffee with the Maestro on Facebook, and we're there, and we're broadcasting from the yard.
Yeah.
So if you want to see what the yard looks like,
yes,
at least
it's live video.
Well, you don't see the yard; you see the side of your house.
Yeah. Well, it was a cold morning, and so we it was like 9 a.m. It was like 30 degrees.
Yeah.
So we sat in the warmest part of the yard.
Yeah.
The snow.
Exactly.
That was only a couple of weeks ago, and all the snow's gone already.
Well, spring comes fast.
Yeah, we had a warm couple of weeks here.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's kind of back to, like, March weather.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Close to 50, a little breezy.
Yeah.
But, Silas was great. Really interesting guy. We chatted for at least half an hour just about what we were up to and what he was up to. And a lot of coffee. Talked about coffee, of course.
Yeah, it was really fun. He's a really interesting guy, and I think we're going to try and get him on the show. He's an orchestra director, but he also has experience with the Army Band, so I'm interested in talking with him about that whole military music. It's kind of fascinating to me. My brother-in-law was at 8th and I years ago, the Marine Corps installation in Washington, D.C.
And your brother-in-law?
My brother-in-law.
Your brother-in-law?
Yeah, my sister's husband. And that's what a brother-in-law can be. But anyway, I went up there to visit him. He was a chaplain there, and I saw the one of the Marine Corps bands.
A chaplain?
Just stop. Drink your tea. Okay, anyway, we're excited to talk to Silas. We thank him so much for having us on his show. If you want to see what we look like, although I looked kind of scary there in my hat and glasses.
You have the Jack Nicholson thing going on.
I don't know. I think it looked like some sort of like 70s rockabilly musician something.
Yeah, exactly. Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
Okay. Yeah. The hair is going
that ended
crazy.
Well.
Yeah.
As I recall.
I'm gonna hopefully go for better activities. Anyway, so check that out, conducting our Coffee with the Maestro on Facebook. Okay, so
I got a wind update.
Oh.
So, I don't know about you all, but now I smell fire. Do you smell fire?
I smell a little
fire. It smells
fire,
like fire.
Then somebody's got the fireplace going.
Well, there's red flag warning up across, like, most of the southern plains.
Ooh.
So maybe we're getting some backflow from fires.
Oh, I hope it's not a wildfire.
Yeah, we're getting into fire season already. Can you believe that?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it's been a poor rain season.
Yeah, it has been. Well, let's hope it's just a fireplace and not a wildfire that we're smelling.
So you recorded some things last week. Tell us about what you recorded.
Oh, with my orchestra?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So we recorded the first movement of Eine Kleine Nacht music. We did Danny Boy.
Uh-huh.
We did the Sibelius's Romance.
Ugh.
And, stop, I know you and Sibelius. And, this is a segue. Did you plan this as a segue?
I may have teed you up here.
I think you did.
Yeah.
And we also recorded the finale from St. Paul's Suite and all of the Brook Green Suite by Gustav Holst, which is our topic for today.
Yeah.
We are talking about Gustav Holst today. And we all are... I just did St. Paul's Suite. You guys are getting ready to do St. Paul's Suite.
Yeah, this is a great topic. We all sort of...
And it fits right in with last week's topic of nationalism. And we talked about nationalism, and we talked about, what qualifies as nationalism.
Yeah, the different kinds of nationalism, not just the program music variety.
Right.
Yeah.
And what we get from Holst and Vaughan Williams, who is his very close friend, we get this nationalism that's really rooted in folk music. And we saw this from all kinds of composers, Bartok, of course, and Dvorak before that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that, Larry, you'd only done the last movement.
Yes.
Of the St. Paul Suite. Brent, are you doing the whole thing?
Well, the plan right now with Campus Symphony at the university is to do all four if they are able to get it up and running with all the other music they've got going on in the next month.
Yeah.
Right now the plan is to do all four.
Yeah.
So I guess we should get right into it then.
Yeah.
You want to talk history first or you want to talk music first?
Well, let's give a little background.
Let's talk some mystery. Some whole
stuff. Right. A little bit of background of them. In terms of like kind of his, like we mentioned his inspirations being folk music, and there is this, big revival of English folk music, a big interest. And it was actually not just interest in English folk music. It was all over the world. And you had these song catchers.
Alan Lomax.
Yeah. And you'd have people who'd go out and collect these folk tunes. Percy Grainger is kind of part of this too. He was Australian and actually became an American citizen, but was really interested in English folk, British folk music. And, of course, his famous Lincolnshire Posy, he went out and did all these old wax cylinder, I think they were wax cylinders, but they're old recordings of these folk songs. So there's this big movement to collect it. And there was also this desire in part of sort of a hanging on of the 19th century nationalism that we talked about last week to create an aesthetic based on folk music for English music. So that's kind of the background, really, for what he was doing. And not everything was folk music. Obviously, his most famous work, arguably The Planets, has really nothing to do with folk music at all.
I thought I'm aware of, yeah.
Yeah, but it certainly St. Paul's Suite and Brook Green do.
Now that I think about it, The Planets, we could make the case, I suppose, that it is, since it's program music, essentially, that it's based on, these oh, gosh, it's... Roman gods, right? not yeah, Greek
it's,
gods.
Well, it's astrological.
Yeah, the astrological. The yeah, the planets. So there's a lot of mythology there.
Yeah, and you know it's you know these are reflections of not the planets as you know like actual landscapes of Mars or whatever. It's a description about this. The planets from an astrological point of view.
So I guess the case could be made that it's sort of folky, if you know.
Yeah,
if you want to go back 2000 years.
Maybe. But there's no English, you know, dance
no,
tunes.
No English connection,
as far as I know.
Well, I don't know. The Romans had conquered pretty much all of Europe, including parts
of
the British Isles.
Pretty big stretch there, but we.
What?
You know
what?
I don't think you can't. I don't care.
No, you all know right. What's a stretch?
I don't think I hear any Roman folk tunes in Mars.
Well,
but I'm just going to go on.
You know what? Well, the Romans stole everything from the Greeks anyway.
All right,
you know what fair. Is? What is a stretch is calling Pluto a planet. Funny story, in 2005 or 2006.
Are we going to have this fight?
I went to go see the Boston Symphony play this, and I didn't know much about conducting at the time, and I looked it up years later. It was Bob Spano was the conductor of this concert. And they did, the first half of the concert, they did some piece that I don't remember, but also then Pluto, written by somebody who I also don't remember.
They just tacked it on the end there?
Tacked on something?
No, they did it as a concert overture.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but then they went right into Mars,
okay.
If I recall.
So they ended with Neptune.
Yeah,
good.
I think so. No, wait. Oh, gosh, I can't remember. I don't know. But anyway, long story short, of course, Pluto is no longer considered a planet, so we can't.
Much to my sadness. Are you pro-Pluto planet?
I'm pro-Pluto. No, I mean, Pluto is not a planet.
It's a dwarf planet.
It's like the size of Ceres.
You guys got to stop. Yeah. I know all the science.
I'm still waiting for the Earth movement.
The Earth movement.
Where's the Earth movement?
Have you seen that Rick and Morty episode? Pluto is a planet.
No, I haven't. Wow. But I know Neil deGrasse...
Way to extend your audience base.
Yeah.
I
love that nihilism.
Neil deGrasse Tyson does make an argument against it. But I don't know. I grew up with Pluto as a planet, and I'm just hard to give it up.
It has an irregular orbit.
I know.
It's too small.
I know.
And it's way, way, way out there compared to Neptune. I mean, it's
I
just,
understand.
You know.
I know the cases, but it just hurts my heart.
Well, anyway.
But the point is that Pluto was not discovered
at the
time. I was
going to say, it hadn't been discovered when he was writing this.
Yeah, that's right. So. That's why it's not there. It had not been discovered. So Hulse didn't have to deal with the sticky wicket of, is it a planet or not?
No, it ends with Neptune, yeah.
Since we're talking to planets, let me turn to that page in my show notes. What's cool about this, or what's interesting about the planets, besides the fact that it was, based upon astrology, right? It's that every single movement is so distinctive,
True.
And I conducted it last.
Fall,
yeah, fall 2019.
Great job with that concert.
Thank you. Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
I saw you miss that 1-5-4 bar though.
Oh, stop. I didn't miss any 5-4
Mars
bars.
Is hard.
Mars is deceptively hard.
It's deceptively hard.
You have to... There's spots in there where, you kind of hold on for dear life, and you got to really hear all of those
the
little...
The hemiolas get me.
Yeah, you got to really make friends with those hemiolas. And the first time I did it, I was just like desperately trying to count through it. By the time I did this, when I did it this last time, I had made friends with it, and I didn't feel the need to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and kind of keep it in my head. But it is deceptively hard. But they're all very different. They're all like climbing a mountain. Mm. You know, they're. I remember when I finished with Mars, I'm like, oh my god, I got 6 more to go. That's like, how am I going to make it?
Yeah.
But they're all very unique, and you don't really hear thematic material coming back, which I really like because it really makes them individual, unique. But you still have the thread of Hulse running all throughout it.
Such wonderful personality in each part.
Yeah.
What's your favorite movement?
Oh gosh. That's a really tough one to say.
Mine used to be Jupiter.
You know, I do love Jupiter.
Yeah.
I love the hymn, too.
It's a crowd favorite,
I mean, that's just
was
gorgeous.
It a hymn first or a hymn second?
No, it was a hymn second.
Yeah.
So he wrote it, as part of Jupiter.
Yeah, church every now and then,
You
hear it in church all the time.
Yeah, so it's the hymn is called I Vow to Thee My Country. Hulse, I believe he did it himself, adapted the slow movement, the slow theme from Jupiter to fit with this hymn tune in 1921. So it was several years after the planets were written through 1914, 1916. He approved of it, I know at least. The hymn followed the tune. But I mean, you listen to it, it makes sense as a hymn tune. I mean,
it does.
It just sounds like a English hymn tune. I mean, Yeah.
I have issues when groups really drag that out and over romanticize it.
Oh no, yeah, it's got to keep going.
It's
got
to keep moving, yeah.
It's like a 2-to-1 ratio. I think I got my score here.
Some of those transitions are a lot easier if you just go with that metric conversion.
Yeah, let me
pull out
go into the old score here. See what wisdom I did back in the day.
I think Venus might be my favorite.
I was going to say Venus is probably my favorite.
Wait,
Saturn has some really interesting moments.
Which one is?
That's Mercury.
Oh, that's Mercury. That's my favorite one.
How does
Venus go?
One.
Yeah.
I should know this right off the bat here.
I don't remember off the top of my head. Venus is that kind of slower, kind of moving undulation.
Yeah,
that's going on.
It's much of a, you know, really a contrast to Mars. It's got that really, slowness. I can't find it. So basically, I took what was the half note in the old tempo becomes the quarter note in the new tempo, which is exactly what he has written in the score.
Yeah.
I just did what he told me to do.
Yep. And it worked. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. And what I do is I just conduct the last two bars of the fast tempo as if they were in a three pattern. So I go 2-3. Ba-da-di. So anyway, I just kind of
pick up. Yep.
Hypermeter it there. So anyway, follow the rules, man. He says it right there.
I think it's fascinating when you talk about the planets. You know, obviously that's the one he's most well known for. And it's really kind of his only successful large-scale orchestra work.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he dabbled in some operas that kind of tanked. And he's got his choral fantasy, and he's got some other works like that, choral symphony and things.
I don't even know his other stuff.
You know, he never wrote a true, like, full-on symphony.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
I guess it was sort of late for that.
Yeah,
I mean, it had all been done.
You know, it's interesting to me that that's sort of the one work that's sort of just this massive orchestra, sound, and contrast. And then really the rest of the repertoire that we're familiar with is either a bunch of choral stuff, some of which is really great, or kind of these little suites. Smaller ensemble chamber kind of music and folk tunes and things like that.
And what I remember about Holst is like he actually was kind of he didn't like being famous.
Mm.
He kind of was freaked out by it a little bit.
And it's interesting because the shy guy is a trombone player, by the way.
That's true. We are the shy retiring type.
So
except when you get to rehearsal.
Yeah.
Then everybody knows you're there.
It's funny to me that to think of this guy who wrote such a what we consider now kind of one of the epic, you know, orchestral pieces that orchestras will do, not only for the money, because everybody's going to go see it, but, you know, it's so iconic now. But yet it's really the only one of that size and scope that we have from him.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else seems to be much more intimate and kind of really contained.
Yeah, that seemed to be the trend, too, I think. A lot of composers, and I guess I would call.
Well, I see this more though in the English composers than some of the others.
Okay.
Because I mean, you look at some of the Russians. You've got Stravinsky working on these massive ballet things.
Yeah.
And
even then, they're only like half an hour long.
They're not long, but they're big and they're complicated.
Yeah, it's no Mahler though.
And well, Mahler had passed away what 1911 or something, and so we're coming off of that. But you've got Rachmaninoff, who's started ratcheting up.
Long-winded.
And he's still doing large form stuff as well. So, but I see this with English composers, especially at the turn of the century, into 1900.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, and then maybe it is just reflection of back on kind of what it means to be English and nationalistic views that way. But all of a sudden, they sort of go introverted with their writing. You know, even Vaughan Williams, he's got some large sweeping pieces that are fantastic, and I think he's underrated.
I love
underperformed.
His symphonies.
Quite a bit, but. You know, they seem to, and maybe it's just because they're on their own little island in the North Atlantic, but...
Quite literally.
They just, I don't know. I don't know what it is, why they sort of kind of went minimalistic in a way with how they compose music.
I love that, though. It's a really good observation. I grew up with Holst's suites for wind band.
Mm-hmm.
First and the second suites in the Fred Fennell tradition. And just adored, especially the first suite.
Yeah.
And have come to love the second suite as much, as well as the Hammersmith. I don't know what you would call it. It's not a suite. It's like a one-movement thing, which is, I think, some of his finest writing. It's not as user-friendly. I want to say it's not as accessible. It's dissonant and kind of dark. but it's brilliant composing. But I think the point you hit on, Brandon, is absolutely accurate, where folks like Vaughan Williams and Holst were, and Granger, Percy Granger, were coming up with these almost variations on a theme. The theme being find like a small chunk of melody or some folk tune or just a kernel of good stuff and develop it just enough and then be done with it. And I think it's really efficient and really refreshing.
I don't know if it was the teacher in him, and maybe that's why, as he was looking for stuff that's going to be good for his ensembles or the groups that he was associated with. You know, maybe that was part of it.
Oh, that's a good point.
But, I mean, you look at him and his teacher's Stanford, and you've got Walton composing at the same time right now, and all these things that are just like these little tiny there's a lot of music, but it's all kind of these small little things that are they kind of catalog themselves into
and sort of these pastiches.
I think it's interesting.
I wish Ashkan
that the English here. Composers went this route.
Ashkan loves to talk about this sort of thing. He's got a sort of fixation with tempo and rhythm and duration. He thinks it's so important, and a lot of composers aim to be big when they don't need to be, I think.
Yeah,
I don't want to speak for him, but
well, he might come by.
He might come by.
He might just
never
walk
know.
Up
he's
here.
He's in the neighborhood.
Yeah, he's he couldn't come at the designated
top
hour
show, yeah.
dictated by my rehearsal, but he said he might drop in. So,
well, Brandon, you bring up another good point, which is just I think very accurate. Again, Holst worked for years at a girls' school, St. Paul's School in Hammersmith, suburb outside of London, just to the west of London. And by all accounts, this is a very capable orchestra. And yet, looking at the music, you can see how it's been, not dumbed down, it's the wrong word, but it's been made idiomatic for more amateur players.
A lot of that was his doing, though, because when he got the job, he had to transform a lot of not only their work ethic, but also the repertoire they were doing. So he kind of like took it up a notch. And there was something I was reading about how he brought in a Stravinsky, it might have been Petrushka or something, for them to start reading. and it was like they were not used to that kind of thing. And I know, was it Morley College, the other place that he had
I think so.
Yeah, and it was the same thing there. Is he had to kind of transform the old habit and culture because he wanted to get more out of the students, and he knew that they were capable of that. The one thing I do appreciate with Holst, and I know that this was intentional on his part, partly because he was a professional player in orchestras for himself as a trombonist. And in fact, he played under Strauss when Strauss would come to England and do some of this stuff.
Whoa.
He was in the orchestra.
There's a lineage, a conducting lineage.
Yeah, so, but one of the things I appreciate from Holst is that he always made sure his music was able to be played by the performers. So he wanted to make sure that even though there are some tricky things that happen with the strings and St. Paul's and things like that, it's all playable. Nothing in there is going to stop an orchestra from being able to do his music. Even in the Planets, which is a huge piece.
Yeah,
I hope so.
It's all doable by the players.
My first rehearsal with this is tomorrow night. We'll see how
mine is next week.
So I got to say, as a non-string player, I sometimes look at string parts. I'm like, oh man, that looks hard.
Yeah.
And then it's not as hard as it looks, because in the hands of a good composer, they know how to, like you say, write for the instrument in an idiomatic way. And that's been my feeling with St. Paul's Suite. And even Brook Green Suite, which was written, I think it was written for his junior orchestra there. I'm like, he had a pretty good junior orchestra. I mean, Brook Green Suite's not particularly hard.
Interestingly, though, that
but
was
it's
like
not a
one of the last
part.
Things he wrote.
It was. Died. That was. Yeah, that's true. And this is gets to a question I want to pose a little bit later. But, you know, that's 1933, you know, like towards the end of his life. And he's still in that folk style. But anyway, I wanted to go back to this this folk tradition. So when you listen to Holst's music, and he was, I think we mentioned this, he was like best friends or really close friends with Vaughan Williams. Do you when you hear Holst and Vaughan Williams, do they sound pretty similar to you, or do you really see them some distinctive things about them?
How much of the
school really were these English composers, or were they just quite different in terms of style, but they all just were inspired by folk music?
Well, I know that, in the case of Vaughan Williams, they were pretty close friends at school. In fact, they would critique each other's work as they were producing stuff and not rely so much on the faculty at school for feedback. So they became kind of their own critics of each other's work. And I know that Vaughan Williams has credited Holst with helping him find his voice in a lot of his compositions. I don't know that Vaughan Williams sounds, the more you get into it, like Holst.
Yeah.
Um, be, And part of that, I think, is because he went on and lived longer and did more things than Holst ended up doing. But I think if you look for the folk elements, I think you definitely can hear it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, any of those English composers, though, because, you know, they all kind of, it seems like they all sort of went for the same sort of either rhythmic idea or the same kind of tunes when they set some of their folk music.
You know, stuff.
And maybe it's just something that's idiomatic of England, and things just all kind of sound the same in that respect as far as the folk tunes are concerned. They kind of have the same bounce and sound and quality to them. I don't know.
Another question kind of along those lines. We mentioned how it was sort of a distinctive effort to come up with an English aesthetic. But was there also this effort to kind of react, maybe not against, but maybe a counterpoint to the really thick, massive Germanic, Austrian
maybe,
stuff that comes from Mahler and then Wagner at the end of the Romantic period? It's really
I think there might be something kind of that would be interesting to study more in depth about. But I also think of England too, is they kind of developed on their own in a lot of respects anyway, even though they're close to Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the day, travel was by boat, and that was still a couple of days to get across, in some cases. But what I think has been interesting is even going back as far as Thomas Tallis and Byrd and Purcell, and some of those early and weak, Welks, if you want to go back that far with madrigals and things, they all kind of have their own distinct style that's different from mainland Europe. In far as scope and sound and the way that things are kind of put together, I think there's a more simplistic musical compositional style that develops in England. Not that the music is simpler to do or sing or play, but as far as the compositional style, based on my view of it, it just seems like there is kind of this more folky element to it anyway that is already scaled down a little bit, and there hasn't been. I mean, who's the English or any UK composer that you know that has like this massive grandiose stuff? I mean,
well, you know,
there's
Elgar.
Elgar is kind of the exception.
Yeah,
you know, and
some
he was
Vaughan Williams.
A little bit of Vaughan Williams stuff, but Symphonies, I mean, when you break it down, he's still kind of a folk guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think England on its own sort of started to develop early on, partly because of isolation, I think, but they sort of had their own kind of thing happening where you kind of do get these more, maybe it's more refined nuggets of music, and you don't have these large Germanic traditions, you know, that kind of pervade through Europe, and then you have these waves of Germanic and Austrian sort of sound, and then a French invasion, and then the Italians come through, and you know, or whatever, and you just don't see that in England. At least I don't.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think I agree with that.
Other than, until we get to the Beatles, I guess, when we have the British invasion.
Yeah, so I guess we're saying the geographic boundary, having the English Channel right there, being surrounded
by water. I think there was a literal divide.
Yeah.
That musically, I mean, they obviously crossed.
Yeah, but so much of the world was based on commerce, and if it was difficult to go a place, someplace, you just didn't do it unless it was a special occasion, I guess.
And maybe, maybe there was other factors. Maybe it was the whole language barrier, whereas around the continental Europe, everybody kind of spoke each other's languages because they had to, and they interacted all the time. And England was kind of its own thing all the time.
So you're saying we should have seen Brexit coming? Back in the beginning of back with Gustav. They're just going to go their own.
They're the ones that didn't change their money to match everybody else.
That was the real sign, actually. But anyway, is this English? So do we see this kind of English folk song tradition as part of the larger nationalism movement of the 19th century, as I kind of mentioned it, or is it sort of its own separate thing, or maybe a little bit of both? I don't know. Because I definitely hear connections with the folk traditions that were trying to be put into music in the 19th century with other countries. So I kind of see it as part of that. Mm. But
maybe that resonated with England.
Yeah.
You know, that idea. Because, England, especially earlier on, you think about Handel's time and things like that. I mean, they were a choral nation more than anything else.
Mm.
It was all about singing and choirs.
In Britain?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
More than anything else. I mean, they had instrumental music, of course.
Yeah. Is that,
and that goes way back to the minstrel times and things. But
oh, okay.
But they had a really well-established choral tradition for years and years and years. And I don't know if that plays a part into all of this, too, where that would kind of be really easy to kind of see where the folk tradition came out of, because folk tunes were sung songs.
Yeah.
That's where those came down from. So.
And dances.
And yeah. Dances.
They're dance forms.
Which goes back to the medieval Europe, yeah. Medieval England.
Yeah, I was reading a bit into that. I didn't realize that the aristocracy kind of took over a lot of the dancing thing. And, you know, I've seen Pride and Prejudice, but I've seen them dance. But I also didn't realize that the American square dance came from a kind of British square dancing originally. Yeah, yeah, I always thought of it as like the Southern American thing, but it comes from, of course, it comes from Britain.
Yes, yeah. That's true. Yeah, yeah, a lot of our folk traditions, you can draw kind of a straight line.
What do you think, Larry? Do you think it's part and parcel of the nationalistic movement that was going on in Europe, or do you think it's sort of a little mixture of both?
I think it is a bit of a mixture of both, because I think there was this desire to, as part of the nationalistic movement in general, to assert a unique British identity, to kind of, as we saw with other groups in Europe, to put an alternative maybe to the dominant Germanic Austrian traditions. So it was a bit of part of that. But I also just think it as a general patriotic, British patriotic thing. This was all happening around the time of World War One. And so I think there was some just general British patriotism, not necessarily connected with this larger effort to create aesthetics that were apart from the Germanic tradition. So both.
I think also we can kind of point to the beginning of modern musicology as part of what initiated this interest in folk tunes. I think, yeah. I mean, we didn't have the capability of recording anything until Edison's wax cylinder. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I mentioned Alan Lomax earlier, who I'm the most familiar with as one of the original ethnomusicologists.
Yeah.
And Granger, of course. And I wonder how much of this drive and this push to capture folk recordings of individuals just living in the country, I wonder how much of that was driven by this acknowledgement or this realization of this amazing new technology, really, in the late 1800s, right?
Mm-hmm.
I find it, you know, if we put ourselves in their shoes, I think it's fascinating, like, to know... Oh, all of a sudden we can record these things for posterity.
Yeah. You have this technology and then an awareness that we can capture this. We don't have to just rely on writing it down like on notation.
Right. Now we can have empirical evidence, if you will.
I think it's just as big of a revolution in music making as it was when all of a sudden you have the printing press.
Uh-huh.
And now you can print music.
Yeah.
I mean, notation by itself was a significant step forward than just the oral tradition. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Now that we can capture it and record it, the way it is sound, the way it's sung or done by a particular group wherever they are, that was unheard of. You know, before that, it was sort of replication as best we could when we tried to write down or transcribe what we heard.
You know, conductors, we complain about having recordings. You know, as these bastions of tradition, you know, these early recordings, when in reality, those recordings, which we refer to as reference recordings, they were really just the best guess at the time of whatever oral tradition had been passed down to them.
Sure.
Yes. We don't have original recordings of what Beethoven's Seventh Symphony sounded like. Too bad. I would love to hear that.
You don't?
No.
I'll lend you my copy.
Do you? Yeah. Oh, get out of here.
He's got a time machine. You didn't know that? Time machine and a wax cylinder.
If I could go back in time, that would be, I think, maybe one of the things I would do is to go to premieres of these famous
I think I would
works,
bring those
right?
composers forward and show them what we've done with their music and say, what do you think?
Hey, what do you think?
Like a music version of Bill and Ted's?
Yeah.
You know, like, take Beethoven to the water park?
Like we don't have to imagine them rolling in their graves. We can see them being killed all over again.
Watch them roll their eyes.
Yeah.
they would appreciate that we're much better musicians than what they dealt with.
Oh, sure. I don't know if I could handle finding out that I've been doing it wrong all this time. That's why I always joke in rehearsal. I'm like, well, I'm going to do it this way, and if Beethoven's got a problem, he can call me.
Pun intended?
Yeah.
You can't handle it?
No. See, that's why I don't do handle.
This is why I don't do afternoon shows, because you get the detritus here, of my brain.
The remnants of your thoughts.
I'm making my shopping list over here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about St. Paul's Suite specifically. As we mentioned already, he wrote this piece for his students at St. Paul's Girls' School. And it has heavily influenced with folk traditions. One of them being the finale. Oh, thank you, refilling my tea.
You're welcome.
We've got this this finale based on a folk tune called the Dargazon, which we were discussing before the show starts. According to sources, means a dwarf or a fairy, and then I also read it could mean like an Irish bear or something like that. I don't know. It's something mythological,
like an old Celtic word or something.
Pardon?
Anglo-Saxon word or Celtic word?
Yeah, like an Anglo-Saxon word for a dwarf or fairy or something. And then I read something that it could have been referred to a bear in Irish folk too. Huh. I don't know. But the point is it's a folk song. Yeah. And you know, he was
jig rhythm.
Yeah, he was inspired by folk tunes, and this one is so cool is that it combines green sleeves, the old Renaissance era. Mm-hmm. Tudor tune. What Child Is This? Also use that tune.
Oh yeah,
because it's and you have the 3/4 Greensleeves theme.
Yes, this going wonderful Hemiola.
Yeah, and then you have the 6/8 Dargazon theme that happened at the same time. Which of course you have to conduct it in one.
I was just going to ask, did this come up in undergraduate conducting for you? This example?
No, I didn't do
it because it did for me.
Oh yeah,
well, I remember clearly. This was one of the, like the final exam pieces that you had to be able to show both the dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum and also dun 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 in the same one pattern.
Yeah.
Dum, da-dum, 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 I know that doesn't translate on the radio, but
well, we heard your snapping. So anyway, but the point is that it's a little tricky, but it's really cool when it lines up. Mm. And just by the way, for you guys, have you ever done it before?
No, I wanted to ask you what challenges you found here.
And in this spot, there's two spots where it goes into this mashup section. The challenge is the 6/8 will speed up. The 3/4 will slow down.
Oh.
Dargazon will go faster. Greensleeves will slow down.
Interesting.
And the thing is, and what if that happens? What has to happen is everybody has to go with the 6/8 rhythm. Because you're not going to be able to slow them down to go along with the greensleeves.
Yeah.
And that dee dee da 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 dee da 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 dee da da. I mean that pulse is going to be the more dominant factor. So making
sure
they don't
the short notes.
Yeah, making sure they don't slow down. But also making sure that the people who are doing the Greensleeves tune in 3/4 are staying with them.
Holst
keeping it going.
Holst wonderfully gives us the direction the first time Greensleeves appears, and he instructs to go into one beat to a bar, conducting wise. He says, mm-hmm. L'istesso tempo. And that's actually in the printed score, so I hope I get that question in rehearsal. What's l'istesso tempo mean? It means it's the same tempo.
Same tempo.
It means don't speed up and don't slow down. So there's
just
no excuse.
Keep going.
Yes.
Keep
just
going.
Keep doing it.
Yeah, but they want to speed that up. It's a zippy, peppy little tune. But the people are going to want to slow down. You know.
So you had to be a bit on them.
Yeah.
Technically.
And
so
I told them, I was like, if the 6/8 goes faster, I have to
go
catch
it.
That. Mm-hmm. I can't. I mean, I try to pull it back, but that's going to be the dominant partner, rhythmically wise. So there you go. That's an important safety tip right there for you guys getting ready to do it. You know what's interesting about this last movement? I don't know if we mentioned this earlier. This is almost completely just cribbed, or I guess it's not stealing if it's your own stuff, but it's from his second suite.
Yeah. Yep.
Last movement of the second suite for military band Fantasia on the Dargazon.
Yeah.
It is a little different, though. I don't know if you guys have gone and compared it.
And since I knew the band version first, it's actually thrown me in a couple places. And as I'm doing my prep here, I'm thinking, oh, wait, that's not actually the phrase I thought it was.
Yeah. No, so it starts off the same.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, because the melody comes in, I think, 3 or 4 times. And then you have the first forte where ba-da-da-da-da-dee-da-da, everybody comes in with that. That's all the same. But then what Holst does in the orchestral version, which came second, the band version, where did I have that written down? 1911, and the St. Paul Suite was 1913. He expands some of those sections. Like, he just fleshes it out a little bit. And I can imagine him going back and listening and say, oh, you know, I'd like to just do a little bit more with that. And he also adds in one of my favorite parts of the orchestral version where dun da dun da dun bum 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 ba-dum. It's around like rehearsal 8 or something like that.
Yeah, the duple thing.
Yeah, that's so cool. And then the cellos and basses. That's one of my favorite parts, and it's not really in the band version.
One of my favorite parts is just before that, actually, a few bars, starting at 7, actually, his accents are really specific. And I'm curious to see how well I can get that to come out. The accents are on long notes, and he's got like this sort of slow melodic line happening inside everything else. There's sort of three things happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that's really interesting. Like, starts in the viola and then goes to the cello and then goes to the second violins and then back to the viola. And then, yeah. So he's like, he's essentially trading who has this important element.
Yeah.
Which I think is like one of the characteristics of his writing in a way. He tends to do that, especially in the band music, where he'll change timbres but keep the same melody going or something.
Yeah. So it is very similar. So, but it's just noticeable differences, just slightly. And he changes the ending a little bit. The ending's a bit different. It's still concert master, first violin and bass solo at the end, where it was, I think, tuba and pick or something.
Yeah.
That's different a little bit in the band version, but it's remarkably similar. No percussion in the St. Paul suite. I love the percussion in the band version. It's kind of nice at the loud moments.
Boom. Yeah.
So anyway, there you go. He steals from the best. He steals from himself. So. Lots of people have stolen from him.
Any other technical issues for strings?
Not a lot. Like we were mentioning earlier, he wrote this for his students, and he writes it well. I mean, it sits well.
The other movements are a bit more challenging.
Yeah, no, there are. There's
like
some stuff.
The second movement with the ostinato.
Oh, this poor second violin.
Poor second violin. Yeah. Just have to stay right on it. And interestingly enough, one of the conversations we're having at the university, because we have such a limited number of seconds, we only have five of them, and the way he's written it is to split and share the line in the second violin, so that they only play a couple measures, and then the other half will take a couple of measures, and then they'll take a couple of measures. And we're having discussions of, well, we can't do that because we're going to lose too much of the sound, like the volume of sound, and so we're going to just have them play straight through, which is going to be exhausting for them.
Not
because that line just
really
weaves
annoying.
So long through there, but it's tricky because they can't lose tempo on that. They've got to stick right with the tempo too for this movement. Otherwise, everything else that's layered around it is going to kind of not work very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be really tricky for them, just to continually read with their eyes and just lock it in and go. And then they can look up and breathe halfway through.
They trade almost the whole time,
Yeah, they trade every, like, two bars. But we just don't have enough players to do that, and so I'm cautiously optimistic that it's gonna pay off.
Yeah. So just real quick, so you're doing this with the Campus Symphony?
Campus Symphony, yeah.
Okay.
And we have a pretty small ensemble this year, or this semester, so.
Okay.
But this is, it's kind of funny, when we pulled this out for them to read before we went on this little 2-week away from campus break.
Our circuit breaker.
Yeah. It was interesting. They got excited when they saw it, because a lot of them played it in high school, which is pretty common. You know, these are great little tunes for any kind of school ensemble that has any kind of, you know, that if they have some talent, some level of talent, that these are great little pieces for a high school group or an all-state group or something that they can pull out and do.
It really is. I mean,
so they were very excited, because not only are the tunes catchy in this, it's just they love it. It's fun to play. And our first read actually went really well, not only because some of them have played it, but they were just excited to do it, and they walk away kind of humming the tunes.
And it is really a catchy tune, and it's such fun to conduct. I mean, it's one of those pieces where you just enjoy the movement of it, and the movement and how it marries to the music. And when everybody's relaxed, and it's like you're on this, like, I've never ridden a horse. Well, actually, I did ride a horse when I was a little kid. I got thrown off the horse, and I literally never got back on the horse. But it's like you're riding a horse, and you're just into this rhythm, and you're going across the moors or some other place in England, and it's just beautiful, and it's just rolling along. It just feels so good to move to it. So, yeah. Good. Anything else on St. Paul's Suite?
Yeah, I found something interesting.
Okay.
I didn't find it. It's just there.
You discovered.
Yeah. I discovered in my study of this, fittingly, a lot of the keys that he selects are modal keys, which like Dorian or Mixolydian, which I think is linked to this folk thing, right?
Yeah, as far as my knowledge goes, yes.
But a lot of this is just very, very simple music that he manages to. It's almost like Mozart, where Mozart will repeat a thing several times, but it's a little bit different every time. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it magical, I think. Yeah. And that's why I love Hole's music, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how this opening goes in the first movement. It's a total unison on this melody.
Yeah.
And that's hard. It doesn't look like it would be hard, but everybody's got to do it the same exact way. And when you're playing the same melody on a violin at this and a cello at the same register, it's going to sound different no matter what because they're hugely different instruments. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of curious to see how
that brings
sounds.
Up a question for Larry, since you've actually done this already. Did you have any, if you can remember, did you have any issues, your initial reads with this, as far as deciding what tempo was appropriate for them to read at versus the tempo you wanted to go?
Well, having only done the finale recently, there's not... You talk about differences between like reading tempo and
what you performance. What you wanted to... Because like... Mm. And the reason I'm asking is when we did our first read of this a couple of weeks ago, in my head, I've got my performance ideal tempo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I've got my... Okay, this is where I think they're going to be able to go.
Yeah.
And then I've got my... Then the reality that happens, which was just a little bit slower than that.
Okay.
So I'm curious what... If you approach it that way, too, is like, well, I know where I want to go with this, which we all should kind of know where we want to go with it, right? But, I mean, did you have to, like, how far back did you pull back during the readings?
Well, with the finale, if they're, and they didn't really have a lot of trouble with this, but if they did have trouble with the notes to the Dargazon, the 6-8 theme, you can pull that back, dee, 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 dee,
sure.
dee, you know, kind of do it like that. But when you comes to putting together, and this is really the hardest part, is putting together the 3-4 and the 6-8 themes, you have to kind of take that at the tempo, because the point is that getting the tempos to be steady and lining up. So slowing it down a lot doesn't really help. So you kind of rehearse them separately and get them up to speed in rehearsal like that. And then when you're doing a read-through, if you kind of crash through that section, you just crash through it until they've gotten the notes under their fingers and you can take it up the tempo. But so much about that finale is about lining up 3-4 and 6-8, which you just basically have to do it at tempo.
Yeah. I just had a thought.
Yeah.
I would never do this with a professional orchestra. With youth orchestras and community groups, I like to go to the hardest spots first. And I'm thinking... I just came up with this for my rehearsal tomorrow night. I'm going to go right to this 3-4-6-8 thing, and I'm going to have them clap 3 versus 2, you know? Dump, bump, bump, dump, dump. So at the very least, if they can't play the right notes, they'll know what the rhythm's supposed to feel like. You know what I mean?
You're going to have them do it at the same time, you're going to have them clap their own
That'll
part.
Be good for a laugh.
I was going to say.
No, exactly. Yeah, I can do it the same thing. No, they'll clap their own parts. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think it's a great teaching technique.
Yeah.
I've done that a lot with choir groups especially.
Because
choirs, for whatever reason, are notoriously heckled for their lack of rhythm.
And they need to be able to feel the rhythm.
There is some truth
to
that. But I think it's a great technique. I've done it with my orchestra too sometimes. It's like, okay, guys, sing this part. Sing your part in rhythm or clap your part. And then stomp your foot.
Here's a tip also for rehearsing this. I might, if you do have trouble with these 3-4-6-8 combinations, have a sectional with the violas and the seconds. Because I could have this wrong. I don't have my score in front of me, but you can check. You can keep me honest here. I think the violas play the 6-8 throughout.
Yep.
But the seconds go back and forth between 6-8. No, the seconds play 6-8 throughout? I think it was the violas.
They go back and forth.
The seconds go back and forth, but the violas play the 6-8 throughout, correct? That's what I think. Anyway,
at cursory inspection, yes.
If you put those two together, it's going to be the hardest in my experience to have the seconds going from 6-8 to 3-4 back to 6-8. And if they have the violas with them together, just those two, then they can kind of get a sense of the line they keep jumping in and out of. They jump in with the violas and then they do the 3-4. You know, stuff to keep pace with the violas, and then they jump back in with the viola melody. So if that spot's difficult, doing a little sectional with just those two sections would be helpful.
That's good to know. So, I'll keep that in mind. I might do that. Brendan, to speak a little bit to your question about rehearsal tempos, I really like to show people from the very get-go
where
my goal is. Yep. And that way there's no questions. I can always refer back to that. Just a really short anecdote. When I was doing my undergraduate degree, I took some jazz courses. It was a jazz combo. It was essentially an ensemble course where we would just play jazz standards in a small, you know, piano, bass, drums, plus some wind setting. I had one instructor one time, incredible bass player, who loved to say things like tempo di learno and tempo di performance. And I've stolen that. I think it's brilliant. So so with especially with community groups, they love this, and the kids love it too. They I'll say, okay, this is what tempo di performance is going to be like. This is just to show you. And then I said, all right, now we go to tempo di learno, and I'll slow it way down.
Along those lines, I have the tempo to terras.
Tempo to terras.
Which is a little bit faster than presto.
Tempo to terras. Tempo to turtle ass or something. The hare and the turtle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah. Good. Well, if I can, we've kind of gone granular level. If I can pull back out to wrap up the show, kind of back to 30,000 feet. So, you know, looking at Holst's dates, born 1874, died 1934, and then I especially like with Brook Green Suite, written in 1933. I mean, is he romantic? Is he modern? Is he just individual? I mean, we like to put these bright lines. Okay, yeah. The romantic period ends. I usually put it around the end of World War. The beginning of World War One, or you know, in that area,
because
World War One was such a traumatic event for Europe, and afterwards there is this sort of because of the modern mechanization of that war, and it just kind of like changed everybody's perspective, and my understanding of it really served to disrupt these romantic notions because it was just so horrible. But anyway, but you know, you still have Puccini writing clearly romantic operas into the 1920 something. But anyway, so where is he? You know, is he romantic?
I think it's hard to catalog him that way because he had such a varied interest in his musical style. I mean, initially he was under the spell of Wagner and Strauss, and I think he wanted to go that direction, but a lot of his compositions flopped because he just. It wasn't his voice, and I think he discovered that. And then he came and sort of started getting into this folk tradition with Vaughan Williams and other schoolmates and things, and that became obviously what worked for him the best. But he also went through this period of exploration in Indian music with the whole colonization movement that with England going into India, and he started to get involved with that, and then that's where this whole astrological stuff started coming out of that. For the planets. And so I think he was kind of, I think there were, maybe it was the educator in him wanting to explore these different aspects of music and try to see what worked for him. And because he did experiment in all these different styles a little bit. And, you know, he obviously was not a modernist. He was not going to go the route of where Schoenberg and Berg were headed and Webern and all that. That didn't work. And it wasn't. That wasn't his thing anyway, and I think he kind of then came back to the more folk accessible tradition that was more his own voice, I think. So I don't know. I don't personally classify him as a romantic composer. I don't think the repertoire that he left would rise to that level. As we look at it.
I have trouble with labels in the 20th century.
It becomes problematic.
I think once we get past Wagner and Liszt, it becomes very difficult to say what something is. If we're talking about romanticism in the vein of Brahms or late Beethoven, I would say absolutely not. If we're going to talk about romanticism in the sense of really post-romanticism in the sense of Mahler and Webern, early Webern, I would say absolutely not.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about romanticism in the sense that music should be a free expression of emotional ideas and or programmatic ideas, then I would say maybe.
Yeah.
But I call him a 20th century British composer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's I think it's really just really hard to put anybody in a box after Schoenberg especially.
Yeah.
Unless composers, I think the distinction for me is the earlier we get, the more uniform styles are across nations and across states. The later we get, the more varied styles are. But that doesn't mean that composers can't write in a classical style, like Stravinsky's neoclassical style, or or Vaughan Williams' romanticism in his Fifth Symphony, for instance, or the Seventh Symphony, and so on and so forth, or the expressionism, if whatever that means, of later composers like Stravinsky, who, of course, were taking it 50 years after it had been invented. I just don't think it's an appropriate label to say that he's a romantic composer. If anything, I would call him what's the word to look for? Not nationalistic, but the word's not coming to me. British. He's a British composer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's very British. And like, and it's well, not just with the folk music, but also all the band stuff. I mean, the bands.
Yeah. That tradition, yes.
Yeah, long tradition of brass bands.
Yeah.
By the way, have you ever seen Brassed Off? You've got to see that movie.
So many people have told me to watch that.
It's such
I
a
should
good
just
movie.
Do it.
It's such a good
it's
movie.
It's like up there with The Replacements.
Yeah, that's totally your
see
movie.
That too.
That's
yeah.
a great movie.
Thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah, because it's music and politics, and you like both. So there you go.
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with both, really.
Fair enough. Yeah. So they do too.
Not
in the
equal
movie.
Amounts. They mostly hate with politics, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, there's a great band tradition. You know, we should do a whole show on band music.
Band
we should
music.
We should
we
make that happen.
See if Silas wants to come on.
He would
that.
Be a good guest.
Yeah,
for that.
He would.
He would definitely be a good guest. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I kind of tend to go with you, Matt. It's hard. That's why I posed the question. Mm. And it's hard with a lot of composers. But if you when I think of something like Stravinsky, I think, oh, modern composer.
Yeah, but what does
my
that
brain
mean?
Just goes
yeah,
to that. I know,
yeah.
But what is because there's all these isms,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
He was classical. He had. Primitivism,
Well, and also
we discussed on our Stravinsky show. All
there's
these
an
things.
Aspect to that, to this that we haven't mentioned yet, which is the distance in time from that era. We're still too close to be able to say, "Oh, this is what it was." I think, just like right now, like what we call the era we're in, we call it contemporary. Well
that's for,
anything for anybody who's alive.
That's
at
for
any
our
point
descendants to determine
yes.
who we are.
So I think
let's
just
hope they
just
don't call
soon.
Us the idiot era,
yeah.
So, the moronic era. But anyway, those guys knew nothing about music. So with my kind of view from Holst, I look at like the planets conceived of in 1913, same year as Rite of Spring. Yeah, 1913, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think of them, I mean, they're wow. both monumental works, but I see them as such different works. I mean, they're of course different styles, but just they seem like from a different time. Almost.
I disagree.
You do?
I feel
okay.
like the planets definitely feels like it was written in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you why exactly, other than some of the later movements are very dissonant.
Well, okay, so certainly with Neptune, right?
Yeah.
The way Neptune ends with this very quiet, and the choir just singing, and the orchestra stops, and then the doors close. When we did it at the U, we had them, backstage, and there was audio cameras. It was all
that,
kinds of a fun setup, but it is very. It feels more modern in that regard, but. It doesn't have the same vein as like, and it doesn't have the same feel as something like Rite of Spring in terms of the modern.
No, I agree with that. And
so,
something like Rite of Spring, of course, was like genre bending and era defining.
So,
Uranus and Saturn are even rhythmically what he does harmonically, it's very telling. It doesn't sound like it's Brahms for sure.
Yeah.
But also the orchestra is huge.
Yeah,
massive orchestration.
Yep.
It's like I don't know, like what, 6 or 8 horns or something, and four or five trumpets. It's like it's like a Mahler orchestra, except a bit more judiciously used. I would say, But there is organ even. I mean, it's a romantic size orchestra. You're not wrong to say that he could be called romantic. I guess from that point of view.
Yeah. So anyway, he remains. A little bit flexible in his definition, and we'll just leave it there.
I love that. I hate labels.
Yeah.
Labels
He's just
silly.
Holst, and he writes great music, and it's massive music like the planets, and then it's, smaller, charming suites for string orchestra, and it's cool. It was funny. I was working on Brookreen Suite at the same time I was doing the planets, and the rehearsal letters and the engraving are the same for both scores, and it's like I'm looking at the planets, and I'm looking at the same engraving for Brookreen Suite. It's like, this is the same composer.
Anything,
and it's just like blows my mind.
I'm curious about that did the comparison of those two pieces enlighten you in any way as to how they should be performed?
No, not particularly. It was more just sort of I was working on them at the same time, and just being reminded that this was the same composer would kind of just mess with my head.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Which piece is this?
Yeah. Yeah, you'll know the difference looking at the score, which one's which.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, thanks so much, guys. Brandon, any parting thoughts on Holst?
You know, I think the one thing that I really appreciate about Holst is his accessibility for not only the audience, but for the players.
Yeah.
And I think no matter what level, and I think, Matt, I think you were saying this, is kind of no matter what level they're on, I think you can do the planets. You can do that with a professional orchestra, of course, or a great school orchestra. And then you've got these smaller things like Brook Green or something like that that's great for, you know, a community orchestra or, you know, a school that's kind of just getting their string program going or something like that. So I think it kind of he hits on all levels. And I think it goes back to that education side of him. And I think knowing that his passion for teaching music and wanting people to play music, I think that kind of comes through in his music that he left us.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right. Well, thanks, gentlemen. This has been a very good discussion. Good luck with your endeavors into the St. Paul Suite. It's a wonderful piece. So anyway, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Don't forget to check out Silas's Coffee with the Maestro. Watch our episode, of course. Do that first. But then go back and watch all the other episodes. He's got some really fun conversations. It was such a good time. So we thank Silas once again for having us on the show. So that's it for this week. Make sure you hit subscribe and stay alerted with all of our new shows. And until next week, this has been Conductor's Brew. Have a great week, everybody.
Cheers.